Hey, Peter Biello here, host of The Bookshelf from NHPR. Just a quick reminder, bear with me for a moment. We are at the tail end of a pledge drive here, and we're asking for listeners like you to chip in a few bucks to help support podcasts like The Bookshelf from NHPR. Give at nhpr.org. You can give $100, $200, whatever works for your budget. Maybe $5 is fine for you. That's totally fine. Your participation is what matters. Your vote of confidence in what we do is what matters here. So make a contribution in any amount. We'll really appreciate it, and it'll help us produce more of the kinds of interviews you're about to hear. So thanks very much. NHPR.org is the place to give. Here's The Bookshelf. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. The myth of the Minotaur, the beast with a bull's head and a man's body, has been with us for centuries. New Hampshire author David Elliott has found a way to retell this story. In Bull, a novel written in verse, Elliott shares the voices of familiar mythical figures, such as Poseidon, Minos, and Theseus. And these voices are nothing like what you will find if you crack open a translation of Homer's Odyssey. Just a warning for this interview, though Elliott's book is written for a teenage audience, some of the language and ideas in this book and in this interview may not be suitable for small children. David, thank you so much for speaking with me.
I'm so happy to be here.
So let's start with a reading. Can you read a little bit of Poseidon's voice to give us a sense of how he sounds?
I can, and this is really how the book starts, and should I read how the book starts?
Please read how the book starts.
Okay. Poseidon. What up, bitches? Am I right or am I right? That bum Minos deserved what he got. I mean, I may be a god, but I'm not unreasonable. And when I am, so what? Like I said, I'm a god. Reason's got nothing to do with it.
So just a very short introduction of what Poseidon sounds like. He doesn't sound like the formal Greek that you will encounter if you open up, say, a translation of the Iliad or the Odyssey. And I believe that was intentional.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's really not how the book starts. There's a little prologue, as you know, before that. That's just 11 lines long. The whole book is in verse. And I had that prologue in my head for probably 5 years. And I never wrote it down. I knew it was about the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur, but that's all I knew. I mean, it was one of those things where I repeated it to myself. When I was doing the dishes, when I was falling asleep, I would say it to myself. When I was walking the dog, I would repeat it. But I could not get farther into the book. I just felt kind of locked out. And then one day, for reasons I don't really understand or even think I have to understand, I heard Poseidon say, "What up, bitches?" And I thought, oh no, but also, oh good, because that's really what gave me an entrance into the book. That's what unlocked the door.
Mm-hmm. And you're writing this for people of high school age.
Yeah, for older teens, yeah.
Yeah, so this is the kind of language that's provocative enough to make it seem like, wow, I shouldn't be reading this. This is a little risque.
Yeah. But that really wasn't my intention. I think, you know, it was interesting because when we first sent the book out for some pre-advanced stuff, publicity, blurby kind of stuff, lots of good things came back. But the first two things came back were from, one was from a bookseller, I think, and one was from a librarian. I'm not really sure. But they both said basically the same thing. Once I saw that word bitches, I stopped reading immediately.
Hmm.
And, you know, I understand that. I think that would make Poseidon very happy to hear that because he kind of comments on that kind of attitude in the book. But on that same day, I watched a rerun of Modern Family. And Alex Dunphy, who's the smart girl in that family, it was school award day. And the first thing she said to her family was, well, she used the word bitches in there, like, I think it was like, clean off the shelf, bitches, mama's bringing home the trophies, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I knew it was part of the language of young people. But for me, I wasn't really thinking that when I wrote the book. I just heard Poseidon say, what up, bitches, and I thought, okay, that opened the door for me. I understood who he was going to be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this reminded me in a sense of the surprise I felt in college when I first read some of the Greeks, about how dirty they can be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
you know, I mean, just to recap in this story. So Poseidon, he offers up a white bull for Minos to sacrifice. But
Minos decides not to sacrifice this bull. So Poseidon says, well, I'm going to get my revenge by making your wife incredibly desirous of this bull. And so just to use clinical sort of a clinical language to describe it, she ends up copulating with this bull, and the offspring, of course, is the Minotaur at the center of this book. And I read that scene and was trying to think, how do you write a book that is marketed for teenagers that has that in it?
Yeah. Well, that was problematic as I got to that point in the book. I think a lot of people don't realize that almost anything goes in YA literature these days. As my friend Tobin Anderson says, anything goes but really smart teenagers. People don't want to read about them. I don't know if that's true or not. But, you know, like there's a writer named Francesca Leah Block who really originally thought she was writing for adults. And when the editors got that manuscript, they said, oh, no, this is for young adults. And I mean, it's very urban. It's very gritty. Every possible thing you can think of that would shock you are in her books. But it was still, I don't know of too many books that have, like, sex with animals. So that was kind of tricky. But I did the best I could with it.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me as something that as a teenager you'd be like, wow, this is something adults don't want me to read. I need to read this.
Yeah. There's some of that, too. But it's also, you know, it's also in the myth itself. So that same adult who might say, you should not read this book by David Elliott, might hand them, you know, Ovid or any of the others who wrote down these myths. And they would find that same information in there.
Yeah. So what draws you to this myth?
You know, I'm not really sure. I have always loved the myths. And I came to them, by the way, through Scrooge McDuck. My family was not a very rich family. In fact, we were very poor when I was growing up. But somehow, and my family was really not literary. Both my parents, my dad, I think, maybe finished eighth grade. My mom didn't finish high school. But they were both, they had a lot of native intelligence. But they weren't readers, especially. So, but in my house, there was a big box of comic books. And I don't know where those comic books came from. I have two older sisters. There was a lot of, like, true romance comic books in there. But there was also a lot of Scrooge McDuck. And one of my favorites was called The Golden Fleecing. And in that book, Carl Banks, who is the creator of Scrooge McDuck, just did a takeoff on Jason and the Argonauts. And so Scrooge was after the Golden Fleece in that book. And so the myths came to me through that. And I loved the stories. And I remember then later when I was older and got introduced to the real myths, I thought, wow, they stole this from Scrooge, you know. But I think my pleasure in the myths really comes from that sort of illicit pleasure of reading comic books younger. Why that myth in particular? I don't know. You know, the Minotaur, we love heroes like Theseus. And I understand why. But after a while, it gets so tiresome because we see this hero over and over again.
Theseus being, of course, the sort of perfect Athenian who ends up founding democracy. And he's just this flawless, perfectly chiseled young man who just is able to seduce pretty much whoever he wants.
Correct.
Something we see, as you say, fairly often.
Right. And also someone who solves a lot of his problems through the club or the knife or just, you know, banging somebody over the head. And sometimes perhaps they deserve being banged over the head. But I think we show this to ourselves again and again, and we show it to our young people again and again. And, you know, we begin to believe that's the only way there is to solve a problem or the only way there is to be a hero. And so my sympathies have always kind of been with the Minotaur. I mean, it wasn't his fault. He was born with the head of a bull. And as I got to know the myth and I discovered that he actually had a name, which is Asterion, and it means ruler of the stars, that kind of broke my heart because it made me realize somebody loved him. His mother loved him when he was born and gave him this beautiful name. And that just broke my heart because in the end, he becomes the monster of the of the labyrinth. And it also kind of made me think, not to get too highfalutin, but it also kind of made me think, well, each of us has this potential every day of our lives. If we're going to become the ruler of the stars, or if we're going to become the monster of the labyrinth.
I could really tell by reading this that you sympathized with the Minotaur, because I found myself sympathizing with him. He's born, and he's a kind soul, and then all the adults and the gods around him are just using him as a tool to piss each other off.
Right.
And just to let people into this book a little bit, I mean the sections with Asterion, the pages are, they start off gray, and then as the book progresses and as he becomes more and more evil, I guess you could say, more and more like a monster who is disenfranchised by his family, the background gets darker and darker and darker until his words are in white and the background is in black.
Yeah. That, I have to thank my editor, the great Kate O'Sullivan at Houghton Harcourt Mifflin, who bought the book. And even she... it was so brave of her, because the book is really risky, both the content and the form of the book. And she bought it based on, my agent gave it to her, I think I had 25 or 30 pages written. And what she said was, I don't know who is ever going to read this, but I love it. And we actually had another offer on the book that was, you know, for more money. But I just thought, I want to go with somebody who said that and who has that kind of enthusiasm for it, which was so helpful to me. And almost immediately, long before I'd finished the book, she had this idea of to make these pages darker. And I think it really, it's such a smart thing to use the book itself to help tell the story. So I was so pleased with it.
Yeah, I mean, some of the ways the book sort of shapes up. As Pasiphae becomes more and more insane, the words on the page, sort of, you open the book and the words are scattered almost, you know, randomly across the page to demonstrate how her thoughts are sort of losing some sense of coherence.
Right.
So you turn the page and you encounter just this mishmash of words, and you get a sense of what her mind is like without even reading it.
Right. Yeah. That was fun. You know, that was fun for me to experiment in that way. And by the way, that I think I can see the poem you're looking at right now. And what you may or may not have realized is that all those fragments of speech are from her earlier poems. It was probably the easiest poem in the book to write, because I just went back and took snatches from everything else she'd said and then played with how to do the line breaks and arrange them on the page, that kind of thing.
So one of the ways you distinguished one voice from another here is you use different poetic forms. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, first of all, I should say, in full disclosure, I do not consider myself a poet. And how it is that I came to be writing novels in verse is as a mystery, really, in some ways. And I'm not being disingenuous. It just you know, I had this initially this prologue in my head, and it was in verse. And so I knew, and then I heard Poseidon, and it was in kind of a much freer form. And so then I thought, okay, well, if it's going to be in verse, not everybody can speak like Poseidon can. So then I thought, well, what will I do? And I have a really great book. I think I picked it up at a yard sale someplace by a poet named Miller Williams, who's quite a good poet. And he, I think the name of the book is An Encyclopedia of Poetic Forms. And so what he does is he just says, okay, this is what a sonnet is. This is what a villanelle is. This is what a sestina is. And so basically what I did was, I would never suggest this to anybody to try to write a book like this. I was just kind of like a prankster. I just thumbed through the book the way one does a telephone book and closed my eyes and said, oh, that looks good. I'll try that. And so I assigned each of those characters a form. I followed what Miller Williams said. And that's how that got chosen. But what was really interesting to me is I now feel, and people might think I'm nuts, but people think I'm nuts for many reasons, so this is just one more that they can add to it. I actually think my unconscious was kind of guiding me to those forms, because they to me at least, they played a principal part in writing the book, and they really helped shape each of the characters in particular ways that seemed right to me. So it was almost as if the forms were writing the book. It was very helpful to do that. So that's how it happened.
Well, David, thank you very much for coming in and speaking about your book.
Peter, thanks so much. Thanks for the opportunity. It was fun.
That's David Elliott. He's the author of the new novel in verse, Bull. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on David's bookshelf at nhpr.org. We are always looking for reading recommendations from listeners like you, so tell us about the book you simply could not put down. Our email address is books@nhpr.org. Tell us your name, the town you're from, and why you like the book so much. Again, the email address, books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us, @nhprbookshelf. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.